Today on Annenberg Radio News.
When I do the weather, I really get into it. And you've got to kind of get down to the low latitudes. Then you've got to move up to the high latitudes.
We get to know an energetic local weatherman. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for November 14th, 2013. I'm Ryan Bouzion. Police investigators today scoured the home of Assemblyman Mike Gatto's father, who was shot and killed during what police say was an apparent home invasion. The 78-year-old Joseph Gatto was found dead in his Silver Lake apartment last night by his daughter. Police say the elder Gatto was shot in the stomach and his home was ransacked. Sarah Faden is an LAPD media spokeswoman.
Our scientific investigation division is currently at the home and conducting a forensic investigation. As this crime is not known what the motive might be.
Assemblyman Mike Gatto says he is devastated by the news. He lived on the same street as his father. This was the first homicide reported this year in the upscale neighborhood. The dispute over the circumstances surrounding the killing of 23-year-old Carlos Oliva is still uncertain. The family of the man wants to mourn, but he feels held back because they can't get the coroner's report. Danielle Tarasuk has the story.
At 1:30 a.m. on September 10th, sheriffs were called to City Terrace in East Los Angeles. They'd been tipped off that there was a man walking around with a gun. Two sheriff deputies spotted Oliva. What happened next is in question. The deputies say he was carrying a gun. When he ran, they shot and killed him, according to the sheriff's report. The autopsy report can clear up some of these questions, but autopsy reports can be withheld from the public during investigations of shootings involving officers. The Oliva family attorney, Louis Carrillo, says there are other reasons that the report is being held up.
First of all, the family cannot have complete closure. They can't grieve properly without having read the coroner's autopsy report. I believe that Sheriff Libaca is hiding the coroner's autopsy report because I believe the coroner's autopsy report will confirm that Carlos Oliva was shot in the back by sheriff's deputies.
The family wants more information about how Oliva was killed, so they held a news conference today to demand that the coroner's report be made public. They say that the report will help them find some peace. If not, they've got questions. Oliva's sister says there was no way her brother was the man with the gun that the sheriffs were tipped off to. They say he didn't own a gun. The lack of answers to their many questions is taking a toll on his sister.
I have reoccurring nightmares. I can't sleep. I've grown with insomnia, and I don't know what to do anymore. It's very stressful and hurtful. My whole family is completely destroyed.
Michael Giannacco is the chief attorney for the Office of Independent Review. He's also part of the team reviewing the investigation into Oliva's death. He said that, unfortunately, cases involving a deputy gunning down a potential suspect happens numerous times during the year.
The practice at the Homicide Bureau, which investigates hit shootings, is to place a security hold on officer-involved shootings until the time that the matter is completed and sent to the district attorney.
Despite the family's pleas, there's no sign that the autopsy report will be released soon. Danielle Tarasuk, Annenberg Radio News.
Former Boston crime boss James Whitey Bulger was sentenced to life in prison today. The 84-year-old Bulger was convicted of 11 murders from the 70s and 80s. Bulger was on the run for 16 years until he was found living in Santa Monica in 2011. Los Angeles schools rank on the list of some of the worst in the country, but USC's Rossier School of Education is trying to change that. Grace Lim visits Thomas Jefferson High School to see how a new program at Rossier could affect local schools.
Dr. Aisa Riley stands at the front of a classroom crowded with desks, backpacks, and high school juniors. She's helping the Jefferson High School students fill out applications for a scholarship program at her alma mater, USC.
So of these things, which is the best, right? So if you're an academic catalog, that would probably be at the top.
Riley is a pro at filling out applications to USC. She's completed a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degree there. Her former school, USC's Rossier School of Education, announced a new teacher support commitment for graduates of its teaching program. Karen Sims Gallagher is dean of Rossier.
If one of our graduates is struggling at his or her job, He or she can call or email us at Rossier, and a team of faculty members will intervene.
The USC Rossier commitment includes a 24/7 hotline with a rapid response team of 9 faculty. Further support includes mentoring, professional development, web resources, and counseling. I visited Riley's classroom as she weaved her way between desks, looking over students' work. As a 10-year veteran at the South LA school, I pulled her aside to see what she thought of the initiative.
I'm really excited to hear that we have this new program that's going to be able to facilitate help amongst burgeoning teachers, as well as older teachers who just need that extra support.
Jefferson has a few graduates of Rossier teaching at the school. Principal Michael Taft says the program will help them build basic skills, like putting students in teams.
That's always been a little bit of a fear of teachers in South Central LA. How can I put kids in a group? Because I know they're going to go off task and start talking about what's going on the weekend. But teachers who have resources and know how to group children right are the most successful in South Central. So I think that in itself will turn out a better product when it comes to our kids.
Taft's only criticism of the new program is that it's only for Rossier graduates.
I would hope that our teachers that are from USC would be able to access that resource, and maybe on down the line, teachers who didn't graduate from USC would be able to access that, you know? Because we're talking about helping the same kids in the same community.
Either way, equipping more LAUSD teachers with more resources will help improve schools and help students, especially in South LA. Grace Lim, Annenberg Radio News.
The Proud Bird restaurant is counting down the days until it closes its doors. The aviation-themed restaurant has been serving steak dinners across the street from LAX for nearly 50 years. It has become popular for its collection of replica historic military planes and its view of flights landing at LAX. Owner John Talashe has decided to close the restaurant because of changing lease terms of Los Angeles World Airports. He attended today's Board of Airport Commissioners meeting along with some of his employees.
It's going to be very sad. We've had guests come back and celebrate with us, having one more dining experience, and there's been tears and sadness through it, a lot of great memories, so it's going to be a tough time.
Talashe plans to close the Proud Bird 1 week from today. Producer Catherine Davis will bring us more on this story next week. Today's warm weather will be long gone by the weekend. Temperatures will drop into the mid-50s tonight, and this weekend looks to be chilly with highs in the mid-60s and lows in the low 50s. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we hear how one woman figured out how to get strangers to pay for her cross-country move. Former teacher Mark Berndt is expected in court tomorrow on 23 counts of committing lewd acts on children. Berndt will reportedly plead no contest to allegations that he took hundreds of photos of his students at Miramonte Elementary School while they were blindfolded and gagged. The photos allegedly depict 23 girls between the ages of 7 and 10. President Obama has taken flak for weeks over a bumbled rollout of his affordable health care plan. Among those complaining were consumers who found the new plan is more expensive than the ones they originally had. Today, the president stepped forward to answer his critics. He called for allowing consumers to hold on to their current coverage for another year, even if those plans don't comply with Obamacare's requirements. Logan Healy has the story.
If you like your plan and you like your doctor, you won't have to do a thing. You keep your plan.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan.
If you've got health insurance, you can keep it.
If you like your health care plan, you will keep your plan.
For some Americans, that hasn't been the case. According to Michael Cusino, a professor at USC's Keck School of Medicine, about 5% of Americans buy their health insurance individually. That means they don't get health insurance from work, and they don't qualify for government programs like Medicare and Medicaid.
And those are the folks who, if they had purchased a plan after 2010, those plans were being phased out. And some of those people were getting notifications that they were going to be canceled and that they had to buy a new plan that was more aligned with the Affordable Care Act, or they had to go into the marketplace, the exchanges.
A portion of that 5% was notified that their plan didn't meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And when they went to find a new plan on the health care exchanges, they found out they'd have to pay more. The one-year delay is meant to ease political pressure and allow more time for the exchanges to stabilize after a rocky start for the Affordable Care Act. But Cuseno says those unhappy now with prices on the exchanges might not be any happier a year from now. He's been studying the Massachusetts healthcare system on which the Affordable Care Act was modeled.
When they rolled this out in Massachusetts, where they had a similar program, it really took 3 to 4 years for the insurance market to stabilize, for the employment market to stabilize.
A statement released by the trade group America's Health Insurance Plan said changing the rules after health insurance companies have already met the new requirements could destabilize the market and cause higher premiums. Under the plan released today, insurers will need to tell consumers whether their old plans meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. House Democrats were set to meet today to gauge support for the president's plan and a backup plan being developed by House Democrats. Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of Orange County called today's policy change totally unacceptable. Like most Republicans in Congress, Rohrabacher supports a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
The president is supposed to enforce the law whether or not he likes it or not. And if he doesn't like the law, he needs to work with Congress to change it. What we've seen today is a president's reaction to the chaos that he has created and the outrage that is sweeping our country.
President Obama has acknowledged that implementation of the health care plan has not been without problems. Last month, technical malfunctions with the plan's website were widely reported, and it even shut down temporarily, contributing to the president's declining approval rating in recent weeks. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
The students at Miramonte are just a few of the 60 sexual abuse cases that have been filed against the Los Angeles Unified School District in the last 2 years. In July, the school district paid $27 million in damages to families who said their children were abused. There are cases still waiting to be resolved. Amen Oyibike spoke with the mother who says her worst nightmare was finding out what happened to her preschooler.
For most parents, sending their children to school means they're in a safe environment where teachers can be vital parts of their child's education. But recent sexual abuse cases against LAUSD have alarmed both parents and students. I spoke to a victim's mother who gave me a written statement about what happened to her son. Due to litigation, she asked that her identity be concealed. Her statement reads,
"In addition to being in the middle of trial, I am honestly a shell of the woman that I once was. I often wake up and face the reality that my child, my precious baby boy at 3 years old, was molested. And to be quite honest, it feels like death. I can tell you that the pain of learning your own child was sexually abused feels as if it's happened to you. What mother would not let herself be raped instead of her own child?"
LAUSD's Code of Sexual Harassment states that any employee accused of sexual misconduct will receive disciplinary action when reported. But what is LAUSD doing to prevent these things from happening in the classroom? I contacted representatives from LAUSD and the United Teachers of Los Angeles for a comment, but they declined to be interviewed for this story. But attorney Daniel Azizi from Downtown LA Law Group knows why they declined.
Because, I mean, there's liability on their end. I mean, they're still on the hook for Miramonte and whatever happens in the future.
Azizi believes that the school district should evaluate their methods of employment.
There should be safeguards in place, and I mean, that's where you get that negligent hiring. Did they do a proper background check?
Project Sister Sexual Abuse Prevention Coordinator Sophia Lopez says that parents speaking can help prevent sexual abuse by speaking to their kids.
Parents need to, unfortunately, you know, be aware of how prevalent child sexual abuse is. We need to talk to our children about it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of parents that might go, "No, this would never happen to my child." But we can't do that.
Lopez says most children will not come forward about abuse because they are too scared.
No one should be touching you and your private body parts ever, including a teacher. You know, and if someone does want to do that, or does do that, you need to come and tell mom and dad right away.
Azizi believes the impact of sexual abuse on children will be long-lasting.
These are things that, generally speaking, they'll never recover from. That's why it's, I mean, as bad as rape is, it's even worse than that.
Unsolved cases are still being held against LAUSD in court. Amen Oyeboke, Annenberg, Radio News.
Former President George W. Bush is coming to USC on Monday to speak to students on part of a lecture series. Earlier today, I spoke with Gian McKee, a professor of public policy at the University of Virginia. We spoke about President Bush's legacy.
The shift in the way that American military power was perceived because of the difficulties that the U.S. encountered in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, it's hard to foresee that far into the future and something like that, but the degree to which that's going to shape future foreign policy for a long time, I think, will be fairly significant. You know, his domestic legacy depends a lot on what happens in terms of long-term deficit issues, and Medicare prescription drug benefit is a significant increase in federal expenditures. Also, his tax cuts that, you know, you could make a strong argument played a central role in increasing the deficit. And how much of a problem that really proves to be over time will shape something of his legacy.
Specifically in urban areas, mm-hmm. What do you think his legacy will be?
Bush came into office with the agenda of compassionate conservatism and particularly trying to push faith-based initiatives that were often targeted at urban areas. Not a lot of those really came to fruition. There was some effort on faith-based initiatives, but they never really got the kind of focus that it looked like they might during the 2000 campaign. And he also tried to really shift federal urban policy in areas like the community development block grants, trying to shift them over to a much more categorical, focused economic development approach, and actually shift them from HUD to the Commerce Department. Similar changes in the Section 8 housing voucher program, trying to turn them into a block grant. None of that really went anywhere. So I think in the end, the thing that's going to matter or it's going to be most apparent of Bush's legacy in urban policy is education reform, for good and bad. And really the way that No Child Left Behind did target attention on failing schools, often in urban areas and low-income urban areas in particular. You know, how effective in the end the accountability and testing approach is going to prove in those kind of environments, and, you know, it's going to take longer to really tell, and that may shape what we think of as his urban legacy. But I think it's really an education policy.
Okay, I've been here with Gian McKee, professor of public policy at the Milliner School at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Southern California is known for its nice weather, but almost as popular as the sunshine is the man who delivers the forecasts. Catherine Davis had a chance to sit down with ABC7's Dallas Rains. She brings us this story.
It's 4 p.m. on a Monday. It's windy outside, and there's a little chill in the air. A fall storm is moving through Southern California, and Dallas Rains is excited.
Today with afternoon highs only in the 60s. This is a cold air mass coming all the way from the Gulf of Alaska.
He's been on the air at LA's ABC7 News for 29 years, but in all that time, his enthusiasm for the weather doesn't seem to have waned.
Sunshine for everyone and afternoon
highs warm up nicely. Rains, and yes, that is his real name, grew up in Georgia and remembers loving weather since childhood. The way he tells it, the obsession began in elementary school when his class headed into the basement because of a tornado warning. He snuck outside to watch.
And I see these big trees that were by my school just almost touching the ground, and this boiling mass of cumulonimbus clouds, black, and hail started to fall. And then you could see the funnel cloud forming at the base, not touching the ground yet, but forming. Wow, it was so cool. And I just couldn't believe that Mother Nature could do that.
From that point, he was hooked. He studied earth sciences and broadcasting at Florida State University. He reported weather on CNN in the network's early days, and then he got a job offer in sunny California. But his colleagues in the weather world warned him, sunny isn't always exciting.
It's Dallas. It only rains in the winter, and sometimes even the winters are not that good. You're going to go crazy without, you know, a lot of severe weather to talk about.
But for Rains, L.A. was a good fit. With a sweeping head of hair, a perpetual golden tan, and undeniable charisma, there is something about Rains that seems more than a little Hollywood.
When I was talking to Phil before, yes. He described you as flashy.
Yes.
Is that how you would describe yourself?
I think so a little bit because I love, as you can see, I love the Italian
suits. But Rains says there's purpose behind his colorful pocket squares and movie star smile. He's taken to heart a piece of advice another TV meteorologist gave him early in his career.
He always told me, he said, you can't teach the audience anything unless you first get their attention.
And you can't deny Rains is an attention getter. He doesn't just deliver the weather forecast, he performs it. He embodies it.
When I do the weather, I really get into it. And you've got to kind of get down to the low latitudes, then you've got to move up to the high latitudes, and you've got these whirling vortices coming through.
ABC7 has even put up a page on their website dedicated to Rains' moves. His signature weather forecasting style has earned him a big following in LA. And Rains doesn't mind running into fans.
I'll talk to people in the grocery store aisles for 30 minutes if they want to talk about the weather.
Rains spends 5 evenings a week bringing the weather to ABC7's viewers, but he has a busy life outside the studio, too. He lives in Pasadena. He has a wife of 31 years and 3 children.
Yeah, I have a beautiful family. I'll show you a picture.
Oh,
want to see some pictures?
Do.
I know they can't see this on radio, but we can talk about it. So this is the family here.
Rains is also a sports lover. He plays tennis and golf and works out regularly, and he also collects and drives race cars.
I have 2 race cars that I actually race at Willow Springs.
It's a high-energy hobby, but perhaps not surprising for someone who also enjoys chasing tornadoes. That love of excitement and adrenaline are part of what make Rains good at his job, even if his job doesn't excite him every day.
Particularly for me, it's a summer deal. When it's just the marine layer, morning low clouds, afternoon sun, valleys 95, beaches 65. And yeah, there have been times when I come in and go like, but yeah, I think everybody has that.
Another challenge for Rains is after more than 3 decades in the business, he's seen his job change in recent years.
When I first started doing weather, I mean, we had magnets. We had the weather symbols on a magnetic board. I mean, you would walk up and put a low pressure, high pressure, sometimes it would slide off or fall off.
Rains admits, in a world where anyone can get a weather report on their smartphone, he doesn't know how long there will be a place for TV weather forecasters. But Rains couldn't be happier with the career he's had.
Yeah, I just have always felt it was meant to be. I'm a pretty religious guy, so I think that that God just wanted it that way, that he said, you know, kind of smiled on me and said, I'm going to let you do something you really like. So have a nice life.
At 60, Rains says the thought of retirement has crossed his mind a few times. But for now, he says, that's not in the forecast.
That's it. I'll see you again tonight.
Catherine Davis, Annenberg Radio News.
One man claims responsibility for bringing pop art to the masses. It's not Andy Warhol, but LA's own Jensen Karp. Karp earned millions as a rapper before reaching the age of 20. He parlayed that cash into Gallery 1988, an art space movement inspired by movies and video games. Now he's taking his show on the road. Arts and culture producer Graham Clark has this interview.
Good afternoon. Most important question, how's your day going?
Well, it's 180 degrees out. So besides the heat that I did not dress for, everything is great. My first name is Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N. Last name is Karp, K-A-R-P. And I'm the co-owner and co-curator of Gallery 1988. So all year long, we do openings basically every month, 2 a month. And you can learn all about that at gallery1988.com. And then we have a new book, which is called Crazy for Cult 2. It's us and Titan Publishing. And it basically, we've been doing Crazy for Cult for 7 years. And 10 years ago, we were the first pop culture art gallery ever. And Los Angeles became the epicenter for it. Now, we're the only place that can have a Wet Hot American Summer theme show and have the guys from Wet Hot American Summer show up. I mean, a lot of the artists were from here, and we were showing them, and it was really where it all started, especially being so close to Hollywood and where a lot of these pop culture items were produced.
You have a position where you can maybe explain what the whole cult fandom thing is.
People who sort of sought out what they were supposed to like, not listen to just what they're told to like, and that's sort of what cult films represent. And we opened this 10 years ago, me and Katie Sutton, who's my partner. We both went to every place that we were going or where Katie was interning. It was sort of this pompous adult sort of place that really only saw $50,000 paintings to $150,000 paintings as art. You know, you couldn't find anything affordable. Mm-hmm. And we knew that was sort of like a big gaping hole, and we wanted to focus towards 20 to 30-year-old artists. And when we did, we realized their inspirations came from like a whole different set, from movies and TV and video games, and we just encouraged them to do that.
So you've developed your cult following now. Now people
We've become what we inspire and what we were influenced by. Yeah, it's two USC students who weirdly turned a strange idea of doing a pop culture gallery into like a 10-year business.
Hip-hop was a jumping-off point for you. Obviously, I need you to just explain a little bit about what...
Yeah, LA radio station Power 106 had this contest called the Roll Call, and so you would call every day and you'd battle against people.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up winning like 48 days or something in a row, and when I walked out, I basically got offered a bunch of record deals, like $1 million record deal, under the name Hot Carl with a K, and I ended up releasing it. It has Kanye West on it, the Black Eyed Peas.
What was the rap battle like? Can we have you replicate that right now, or do you need a beat?
I'm a 34-year-old man.
So you'll be so much wiser. You'll be like Dostoevsky on the rap battle.
Yeah, no. Talk Carl, we're jumping over competition like hurdles. I keep it on the ground like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh.
Hot Carl from the Valley. And actually, I keep rappers confused like Queen Latifah's sexuality. I don't know. It's kind of mean.
Coming from Gallery 1988, this interview started late.
You just got $1 million record deal.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Read Crazy for Cult or else you are adult.
I took away $500,000, so you now have only a $500,000 deal.
Thanks for your time.
You too. Take care.
Raising money is rarely an easy proposition. One East Coast woman wanted to move her household across the country to L.A., but was stopped in her tracks by the expense of the trip. As Mbalu Tiansi reports, all she needed was a little help from her friends online.
When painter Tiffany Greer decided to relocate to California, she knew she would need many things. A U-Haul, money for gas, and a place to live. But the move was expensive. On the advice of a friend, she turned to crowdfunding and set up a GoFundMe account.
I have a really good friend in Phoenix who has her own GoFundMe site. It's called Pay It Back, Pay It Forward. And she started it before I even considered doing this to get to L.A., but she started it as a way to pay back her student loans, but also give back to the community.
She asked her friends for funding in exchange for future paintings. The success of her friends' crowdfunding led her to launching her own site. And although she didn't reach her goal, she still managed to raise enough money for her move.
In my mind, it was extremely successful because all I really needed was money for a U-Haul and money for an apartment.
When student Cricket Lancaster decided she needed to get out of Los Angeles, she turned to one source for last-minute financial help.
Realizing that a cross-country move is a pretty extensive and pricey endeavor, I decided to go the crowdfunding source because I wasn't making enough money to do it on my own.
Together, they are a part of a growing trend of people turning to crowdfunding to raise funds. For Kendall Almarico, the creator of a crowdfunding website, clickstartme.com, some things are essential before you create a site.
You actually have to prepare. You have to have a plan. You have to have a good plan, and you have to market to make it work the correct way.
According to experts, 90% of crowdfunding sites fail. But for some, the need surpasses these expectations.
I think people go to those funding sites when they have nowhere else to go to.
I think it really comes down to how people market and how people ask.
And as people become more creative, so does their crowdfunding success. I'm Balu Tijansi, reporting from Annenberg Radio News.
All right. Thank you for listening to Annenberg Radio News. Have a wonderful weekend and stay classy, Los Angeles.